Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I met Harry Styles a decade ago, along with the rest of One Direction, when I was reporting a Rolling Stone cover story that, for various reasons, never actually ended up getting published. But I've been a fan of his ever since, and can't say I'm all that surprised that he's become a solo superstar. But my fandom is nothing compared to that of Brittany Spanos and Rob Sheffield, who I think it's safe to say are among the world's leading experts on Harry Styles. And as we're about to discuss, Harry has a new album out called Harry's House. Harry is doing something very interesting as a solo pop star. Again, as we'll touch on, he's having pop hits very much on his own terms. His rock influences and vintage R&B influences are very much his own. He's also become an incredible force live. So it's a very interesting career, a very unique album. And here's my discussion with Rob Sheffield and Brittany Spanos.
You two like Harry Styles. You're willing to be open to the idea that his music might be good. I think it's very fair to say.
We dabble.
You dabble.
We dabble in the Harry Styles fandom.
He has his moments. Yes.
Yeah.
We dabble.
So there is, needless to say, a new album, Harry's House, and it's gotten a very good response. I like this album. We're going to talk about every single track on this album. Maybe the two of you can sort of set the scene and explain where he was last time with Fine Line and what this suggests about his direction and the kind of differences and where he went in general with this for you.
Fine Line was the album where he set out to prove that he could do everything. You know, his first album, he wanted to prove that he could do singer-songwriter stuff. He really wanted to show his chops as a songwriter and to really kind of break from the sort of pop mold. So the lead single was 6 minutes long.
Just stop your crying, it's a sign of the times. Welcome to the
fine. He was very much making a statement about his own artistic independence. Fine Line had pop songs, it had rock songs, it had ballads, it had really weird mushroom psychedelic reggae, it had a little bit of everything, it had Joni Mitchell's Dulcimer on it. So he wanted to prove he could do everything. This is much more of a pop album. It's really laid back and really hedonistic and jubilant and in a really extreme way, which is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I think also, obviously, so much of the first album was powered by excitement, right? Like, there's, like, so much of the fan excitement for the first album that propelled Sign of the Times to number one and made that album such a big success. But with Fine Line, what we saw was someone from a boy band who has stepped out on his own is suddenly becoming a pop star for everyone. And Watermelon Sugar and Adore You and Lights Up becoming really big singles, going against the grain of what pop music sounds like right now and like what other pop artists are doing.
Watermelon sugar high, watermelon sugar high, watermelon sugar high, watermelon sugar high.
So he's really stepping into the power of him being able to kind of do whatever he wants as a pop star, like in terms of his sonic influences. Like there's like a lot of city pop, a lot of funk, all of that. And create really massive hits in the way that, you know, we're hearing with As It Was becoming one of the biggest singles of the year so far and that blowing up entirely. So it's really kind of a victory lap of his own sort of pop power.
I mean, As It Was becoming a big hit is really as notable as Olivia Rodrigo having a hit with Good For You, a number one hit with a guitar song like that. And to say it doesn't sound like current pop is an understatement. It sounds like something you'd hear in a club by a really good new indie rock band in 2004. It does suggest that he's kind of bending the charts to his will, which is a pretty ideal scenario.
Yeah, I mean, he's such like a live artist too, so that factors so much into what his music sounds like. He has a band that he works very, very well with. He's always been a touring artist, but even as a solo artist, he's really made sure to fine-tune that and make that a big part of who he is to his fans and who he is as an artist. He makes music that sounds like it's made to be played with a band and made to be played with, in particular, the band that he's assembled. As It Was is a perfect example of that. Rob and I got to hear it live on Friday, and it's like a perfect kind of live song. You know, it's like the perfect sort of scream-along festival song. But yeah, it does remind me a lot of very early Coachella 2004, 2006 kind of indie rock, like MGMT, Tokyo Police Club era.
Definitely a music cue during a prom scene on Gossip Girl.
He should have made a one song appearance at the Just Like Heaven festival.
Oh, just, yeah.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
But also, you know, Brittany touched on that it's his most confident sounding album, and that this is an album where he's not really worried about winning anybody over. To compare it to The National, I always love something The National said when they put out their album, High Violet. They said that part of the reason that album was so good was this is the first one we knew that even if it sucked, we'd get to do another one. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like what this one sounds like.
There's a lot of like silly moments. There's a lot of really heart-wrenching moments. Sometimes they come in the same song, like back to back. Like, it's just like, it's a really fun album. And also I feel like the first one where I would say pretty much every single song on there could in fact be a single, like as it was, worked so perfectly. But if, you know, he had decided to go with Music for a Sushi Restaurant first, I think that would have also blown up in a really big way, or gone with, you know, like Late Night Talking. Like, a lot of those songs are really fun.
It's really a celebration of this sort of communal creative team that he has assembled around himself. You know, Brittany mentioned his band. There's kind of nothing else like that at that time, where somebody has, you know, he's not doing the tour of the latest producers. Anybody in the business would work with him. He works with, you know, this really close-knit union of collaborators that he knows well, and that, you know, he trusts entirely with his aesthetic vision. It, in so many ways, it reminds me of Janet Jackson and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, and that after, you know, the huge success of Control, she could have worked with any producer out there. They were all dying to work with her, and she kept working with Jam and Lewis because she trusted them, and she knew them, and they knew her. And that paid off very well for Janet Jackson, and I think it's certainly paying off for Harry Styles. But you can't make an album like this with hired guns. You know, you have to have people who are going to, you know, to get it and follow your lead musically.
Yeah. Tell me about Tyler Johnson, who's one of his main collaborators.
He's a fascinating guy. He's a fascinating artist. I think the first time probably the world got a clear view of him was when Harry appeared on Saturday Night Live and did Lights Up with just Tyler playing piano. And really beautiful, really like intimate moment. Also, it was the first time Tyler had ever played the song all the way through on piano. So he was slightly nervous to be doing it on live TV with just him and Harry. But he and Kid Harpoon, they basically did the whole album as a threesome. Mm-hmm. With, of course, like other input from the other musicians in Harry's band. But for the three of them to sort of hole up and do this record during a pandemic when, you know, a lot of it they did at their record company boss's country house. And, you know, Harry had the great story on Friday night about when he wrote Little Freak in a Tokyo hotel room with Kid Harpoon. And he said, you know, it was just two friends in a hotel room, not doing what you think the two friends in a hotel room might be doing. We just wrote a song. But
yeah, yep. Kid Harpoon is a guy named Thomas Hull who chooses to be known as Kid Harpoon. He's worked with people like Florence and the Machine and actually has a pretty long, really long pre-Harry resume and continues to work with people like Shawn Mendes, but really seems to have found a great place as one of Harry's key collaborators. Most of the credits are, the writing credits on this album are Harry with Thomas Hull and Tyler Johnson and a few other people coming in and out. So it's this very, very tight-knit situation. It's really interesting. So let's start with Music for a Sushi Restaurant. It does seem to be advertising a sort of freedom and confidence in the very wacky sort of synth horn parts and almost Oingo Boingo-esque-ness of that and some wacky harmonies, like really just a silliness and fun there. Perhaps not my personal favorite thing. I see what he's going for. And what were your initial reactions to this one, and where do you place it in the Styles canon?
I just think it's such a great opening track. It's a song that lived up also to what I hoped it would feel like live too, which is just like so much fun and such like a party starter. But like, I absolutely love this song. It's definitely in like my top three of the album, a little soul to squeeze type of scatting in there, but I think it's a very fun song, and it's again very, there's like a silliness to the album. I think there's a level of Harry both not taking himself too seriously while also kind of progressing like what kind of music he makes and like how he's sort of talking about his life and you know, using the music as that vessel. But like I think the song is very fun.
Absolutely. I love how it sort of sets the emotional tone for the album. Upbeat, super enthusiastic, super engaged, super passionate love song that's also this really frothy dance pop song. It's kind of great because, you know, his first two albums were so full of, you know, sad songs. There's definitely sad songs on this album too, but the first two albums were so full of breakup songs. And for this to begin with such a shameless love song with, as Brittany put it out, the scatting. I love that little synth horn break, which is so specifically 1986. It's kind of mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. Like, he decided to be Skritti Politti for the chorus of this. Also, the intro, I love the way that this album begins exactly the same way that Talking Heads' Fear of Music begins, with that sort of like little like percussion intro. Sounds like Izimbra. Beginning of the Talking Heads album.
Where do we think he's drawing those silly little harmonies? What is the derivation of that, do you think?
It's well because like there's a lot of 80s R&B on this record, mm-hmm. all over this record, and sometimes it takes over entire songs. But yeah, like that fantastic, like all those he's and how's, like that's, you know, very much like in the sort of like 80s R&B up-tempo roller skating disco specifically. Mm. A huge influence on the record to my ears is Billy Ocean, but like all those Billy Ocean hits, like not just Caribbean Queen, but you know, When the Going Gets Tough, The Tough Gets Going, Lover Boy. I don't know what you got, but it plays with my emotions. I want you so much, darling. I think the Billy Ocean level is pretty high. Obviously a lot of Prince, a lot of also Ready for the World. Mm-hmm. I just think there's a lot of that kind of stuff on this album. There's one song on side two that sounds uncannily like George Benson, Gimme the Night. Give me the night. Give me the night. Not that it has the same kind of, not that it borrows anything musically, but it just has that kind of like sort of late night vibe.
Late night talking. I like the song a lot. I'll say one thing that's really funny is there is a part that sounds a little bit like the part in Dua Lipa's Levitating that she got sued over. I got you. Not saying that there's any liability here, but it is funny. I think if anything, it goes against the lawsuit because it just shows how common the late night, all night. It's just a very common melodic thing. Like it's yeah. So I would bring this up as a case against her plagiarizing. It's just a thing that people do in pop songs. Yeah. Again, maybe place this one in terms of influence and where you think it, you know, what it sounds like to you and what it says about where he's at.
Yeah, I mean, I love sort of like, again, like a lot of the 80s R&B like Prince type influences on a lot of this album. And I think what made especially like the first couple songs on the album really stand out to me.
I love how it taps in specifically when I say 80s R&B, this song is a perfect example. It taps into sort of the zone before Thriller, but after Off the Wall. So it's got a lot of, you know, you can hear a lot of sort of a Rick James thing going on, definitely a Ray Parker Jr. thing going on. I'm a huge Ray Parker Jr. fan. It's even got a Luther Vandross kind of vibe to it, but that sort of like breezy roller skating again, kind of late night talking. Also like the really shameless romantic lyrics, really beautiful. Like I love when he says, I've never been a fan of change, because it's a total lie, but also it's super romantic when he says, you know, I'll follow you anywhere from Hollywood to Bishopgate.
There's a tiny bit of Stevie Wonder in Late Night Talking, which I really like.
Sort of Hotter Than July era Stevie Wonder, and specifically Do I Do, which is a fantastic, brilliant Stevie Wonder song. You could call it underrated only because he's got so many hundreds of famous songs that this is one that, you know, isn't necessarily as famous as some others. But Do I Do is really kind of a perfect template for the kind of vibe that Harry's going for a lot of the songs on this album. When I see you on the
street, my whole body. And Harry deserves much credit for throwing in a diminished chord into Late Night Talking, which is unusual and a very Stevie Wonder harmonic move. Grape Juice, very cool song.
I feel like we've talked about Len a lot on the podcast together, but this is the time to talk about Len's impact.
He absolutely brought out the Sunshine Stealing Guns. I love that song. I know it's up for me. He's song definitely has that. It's a real risk putting like something like this as the third song. Mm-hmm. It's so early in the album, and it's such a sort of breezy departure, almost like a really sort of giddy sort of vibe to it. There's something kind of woozy about it musically.
Yeah.
And it's funny because at first I thought of Grape Juice as, I kind of thought of it as sort of like one of the placeholder tracks on the album. And now I've completely come to love it. It didn't take long to totally flip for it. But yeah. It's a song that for me just kind of sneaks up on you.
Yeah.
Now it's one of my favorites on the album. Also, very strong Paul McCartney circa 1976 vibe, the Wings at the Speed of Sound, which is an era of Paul McCartney that nobody ever takes overt inspiration from. And I love how this one, it's a stoned trombone solo away from being an actual Paul McCartney Wings song.
And Harry is pretty much on record with you of liking that particular era, correct?
He loves those late 70s Wings albums.
Mm-hmm.
He was playing some late 70s Wings on the playlist before the show on Friday night, which is pretty great. One of them was Paul McCartney and Wings from the last Wings album, 1979, Arrow Through Me, which is kind of a deep cut. You can hear that this album was made by someone who loves that, in addition to all the other things he loves.
Ooh, baby, you couldn't have done a worse thing to me if you'd have taken an arrow.
The fact that this album is named after a solo album by a Japanese prog musician, like everybody else, I never heard of the Hosono House album until Harry brought it up last year. I assumed, like everybody else, that it was named after the Joni Mitchell song, Harry's House, which is a great song from a great album.
Yeah.
But it's wild that it's like, oh, yeah, it was, you know, a solo album by a Japanese prog musician from Yellow Magic Orchestra. I completely love that. And that's a great album that I've been listening to since he mentioned it. But great case of how wide-ranging and far-flung his tastes and his musical enthusiasms are.
As you were the first to note, it's obviously great to have a huge pop star who's an enormous record collector geek, and it's yielding very interesting fruit. So as it was, we talked about a bit, but what do we know about how he wrote this and what he was drawing on?
It's one of those surprise sad songs. He sort of described it as being one of the sadder songs on the album, and just started off much more dour and kind of has this really upbeat, like we mentioned, sort of like early aughts, like indie rock, synth rock sort of vibe to it. It's just kind of a very sad lyrically song, but also so much fun to kind of scream along to. And it has become one of his biggest hits yet. I think it might be his biggest hit now. It might have surpassed Watermelon Sugar, maybe?
Probably. I think so. It's been number one for 6 weeks. Also, something great. His show, Brittany and I were both there for the One Night Only show on Friday night, where he did the whole album all the way through. And something that was great was he totally unexpectedly and impulsively he ended the show. He was done. He did Kiwi for the last song. He'd left the stage and just total spur of the moment thing. He came back and did As It Was a second time. It was not just more fun than the first time, but also like it was so like, and it was clearly like a fun run. He'd done his job. He'd finished the show, but he just needed to sing this song one more time. And it was really funny to see also the pogoing. It's a real Ramones-esque kind of bop. I just love how it was a song that, as Brittany said, is such a sad song in so many ways, but is so exhilarating and a total crowd jumper.
I like the imagery of him, the confessional stuff of sitting home on the floor and what kind of pills are you on.
Going out of his way to put his name on that part.
But he didn't put John Mayer on this song, which has the line, "Gravity's holding me back," which is very close to a John Mayer sentiment. They're both, you know, gravity is very tough for when you're ascending into the stratosphere. Gravity is something that you know.
Nobody likes gravity.
Nobody likes gravity.
Nobody's pro. Yeah. Gravity always wins.
Fuck gravity, man.
And in addition to being like a perfect 3-minute pop single, it's also sort of a key to the whole album because, you know, it has so much to do with the concept of home and Harry's house and the idea of home is something that you keep building around yourself to keep that kind of loneliness that Brittany was talking about, to sort of keep that at bay. And, you know, that he's really playing against type, especially in that verse where somebody outside him is calling to him saying, "Harry, you're no good alone. You can't sit on the floor being depressed all the time," which is kind of making fun of his image on some level, but also sort of suggesting that, you know, communities are something that you need to keep building.
Daylight, not to be confused with the Lover bonus track. Different Daylight. Harry Styles, Daylight.
This is like such a summer album, and that's the nice part about it. And this is such a perfect example of that. Just like cutesy lyrics, like, "If I was a bluebird, I would fly to you." Like, I love a little corniness
Well, I love everything about Daylight. It's one of my very faves on the album.
Yeah.
Also, I love that sort of rubbery bass that goes all the way through it.
And Little Freak has one of my favorite choruses on the album.
The title is a bait and switch. I thought it was going to be what cinema ended up being. And I was, you know, it's fine. But like, it's a real, it has some of my favorite like little lyrical moments, like, you know, like I spilled beer on your friend, like, and I'm not sorry. You know, it's like stuff like that. It's, I like those little images on the, on this song, and it is like very cute. But yeah, I'm not always like a ballad. We've gone over this with every album we do a track, but I'm not always the ballad person. It's not where I'm always drawn to on a song, but it is like a fun sort of like little folky little ditty.
You see the title Little Freak and you think it's going to be one thing, and it's very much not. I love that sort of the sucker punch aspect of it. I was expecting something very different. It's funny, the title also evokes Usher's best song. Let's face it. It's funny that this is a song that's very different. As you know, Harry mentioned at the show, it's a song that he and Tom just wrote in a hotel room in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that it was a song that he wrote in time for Fine Line, but he didn't think the song was 100%. He said he just wanted to hold off on that song until it became totally what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought of that as a song that he could have shoehorned onto the last album, but this version is more fully realized.
Yeah.
But the emotional tone of it, I just love the sort of, you know, ironic and self-mocking aspects of failed infatuation that this song talks about.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
And then we get to Matilda, and everyone should read Rob's great piece about Matilda.
You were riding your bike to the sound of It's No Big Deal.
Thematically, it does remind me of Pearl Jam's Daughter.
That's a high compliment.
It's similar in the sense of a very empathetic dude daring to sing about a woman's past with a very rough childhood. I think this one's already inspired oceans worth of tears. Judging from Twitter, understandably, it's a beautiful song.
It was honestly unlike anything I've seen at a live mm-hmm. show, because everybody was so loud for all the other songs. Little Freak, because it's a quiet song, so you could really hear how loud the audience was. And Matilda, it was silent as a whisper. Everybody was listening. People, as far as my eye could see, were just sobbing and just taking this song in. It was really a very emotionally powerful hush.
Yeah. More than any other song is sort of like the nexus of so much of what the album and what the album's title kind of harks to, which is just like, this is about finding home wherever you need to find it. Like, I think for a lot of his fans, they've created such like a great community. And this is a song that is about them finding solace in each other. It could be about finding solace in, like, you know, any sort of found family or created family that you have. And I think that's such a beautiful part of it.
Absolutely. It's just such a powerful song. So eloquently stated, it would have been so easy to ruin this song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a few clumsy moves, a few hammy moves would have been all it took to capsize the song, given the delicacy of the subject matters that he's singing about, that he's also very cautious. I love how he adds, "It's none of my business, but I've been thinking about it." Such a perfect line in terms of framing the situation is, you know, he's the listener in this song, working very hard not to be any kind of main character in this song or in this narrative. And that's part of what makes it so touching.
Yeah.
It's a song about listening to someone, and it's a very difficult and tricky thing to do. But
okay.
What a great, great, great song. I wish this song existed when I was 19. I would have definitely learned a lot about how to be a listener from this song. Really powerful song. I'm glad it's in the world, but I wish it was in the world years ago.
I have a mini directioner group chats, as one adult woman does. And, you know, we talked about it, and you know, it's interesting because it is sort of this, and I think this album speaks to this, where it's like, especially for people who have, when One Direction existed, like there was a sense of this belonged very specifically to people who had a very, very intense relationship to the band, because it was kind of the beginning of the time where bands can like just like be really big and play stadiums without having constant number one hits and like constant major success in the way that we've only considered success before. And like One Direction, they didn't have a lot of number one hits. They didn't have like a lot of even, you know, like top 10, like they were just like massive though still. I think this is like sort of the beginning with Harry, where I think for a lot of people who have come through like the last decade plus with One Direction and with him and it followed through, like this is like, you can no longer gatekeep Harry Styles as belonging to people who have been there since One Direction was on X Factor anymore. Like, I have friends who literally just learned about him with Watermelon Sugar, even after me talking about it for many years. But maybe they should listen to Matilda and learn how to listen to when I recommend Absolutely. Them Harry Styles.
You know, that's actually really interesting, Brittany. I actually wonder, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I wonder if he's already in the U.S., outperform One Direction chart-wise. He has, I guess.
I mean, I'm sure, yeah. And I mean, I think especially, I mean, the success of As It Was Alone, I don't think One Direction had any single, I mean, What Makes You Beautiful was a huge single, but I don't think the way that it charted matched the way that people have a relationship with it now in that way, where I think there's like more of a nostalgia. It's like a kind of retroactive hit in a lot of ways for a lot of people. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because it's like, I have a lot of people who love As It Was and they didn't realize it was Harry Styles. And it's kind of funny to do, you know, how Robin mentioned As It Was coming back and being played as the encore when previously it only been Kiwi, a non-single, was not a number one single. I would say most people don't even know that song exists in Harry Styles' discography if you have not been to a show or, you know, like love him, you know, have just started listening to him. Like, you know, it's kind of fascinating. Like, it's like such a weird moment, I think, for people who have had such like a protective kind of like hold and grip on an artist for so long are now seeing that artist belong to a lot more people for the first time.
I think sequencing this album must have been tough here, because I think there's a few strains. There's the ballads, there's this sort of 80s art, funk R&B / disco, there's the indie rock stuff. I think they found a way that it flows, but I bet that actually was a challenge. I'd be interested to hear them talk about that, which brings us to Cinema.
Your transition from Matilda to Cinema is one of the all-time great album transitions in terms of a total change-up in terms of mood. I think it's going to go down in history as just one of the most audacious.
Just a perfect song. I mean, it is just like, I mean, the breakdown on it alone, like I am just, it's everything I've ever wanted. Like, it's just like so much fun. And it, like, I've said this already, and like, I've told this around many times, where I just feel like it's so influenced by the way that the live band plays the music. Like during Watermelon Sugar, he would do a very similar breakdown during the live shows, where it kind of like had this sort of old school kind of like 80s kind of like breakdown in the middle of it, with like the live band kind of playing and like having fun and riffing, and him sometimes doing like made up songs during that. So I think that's kind of, it's wonderful to see that reflected on this particular album and with a song like that, where it's just like my favorite thing.
There's something very funny to me about how he writes this elaborate Watermelon Sugar metaphor, and then this song just like completely removes the metaphor, just says what he's talking about.
I will say, someone pointed out something I didn't realize, which is Cinema is like the Greek origin. It's like for movement. And I did not realize that that's what, I was like, why Cinema? I was like, why is Cinema the title of the song?
Oh, I thought it was about a pop star dating a movie star.
Yeah.
Like that could happen. I thought this song was called Cinnamon when
Me
I heard
too.
It.
I thought it was Cinnamon too.
And that seems like a very on-brand Harry song title, because the man loves to sing about food. Let's sing it. No album in history has had as much breakfast on it as Harry's House.
A pop star dating a actress/director would be even more precise, I think. I bring the pop, you got the cinema. What could it possibly be about? It's a mystery. Someday we'll solve it. It's really subtle, but I think
it's for the Greeks.
That's right.
Yes.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, ask Sophocles.
Yeah, I'm not sure I needed to consult my Greek origins reference text to figure out what that song was about, but I appreciate the effort. It's like when a song is called Oh Yoko and looking up what Yoko means originally. Like, I think we know. But yes, good effort, though. I think it's like...
For this song to be right next to Matilda at the very center of the album, and we know he takes running orders very, very seriously. You know, these two songs that are total emotional extremes, but Cinema is kind of perfect to sort of kick off side two of this album. I mean, pardon me calling it side two, but this is a really backloaded album. At this point, like Cinema, it's banger after banger.
Yeah.
We have Daydreaming, which just goes ahead and samples some vintage funk to, again, make the implicit explicit.
Yeah, this is a song that I feel like hearing the live version made me love it even more. It's so catchy. It's so fun. I want to blast this in a car, windows down, and like just scream it. Like, it's so good.
Those Quincy Jones productions with those nice squiggly rhythm guitars on the sides. On this song and others, the Michael Jackson Human Nature kind of thing, that kind of rhythm guitar sounds. There's a few of them on the album, and it's really nice to hear.
Yes. And again, that phase of Stevie Wonder is really key to songs like this. Again, like George Benson, this is a real gimme the night kind of groove, turn your love around. That was kind of when he was in his sort of lush, up-tempo R&B dance pop phase.
I really like Keep Driving.
Black and white film camera, yellow sunglasses.
My number one. I love this song. James Joyce is shaking. Like, it is just like full-on consciousness. Like, it is so good. I am obsessed. Cocaine side boobs, choker with a sea view, amazing, incredible. It's so much fun. I love this song. It is like, I've been listening to it on repeat, just like playing it while I'm washing dishes. It is just like perfect to me.
And it is back in that the indie rock / Lencore area. Again, I love that there's these different threads going through the album that you kind of return to.
A lot of people were roasting the song because it's like so, it's just like word association, just so many things. The way that it sounds and the way that it kind of flows, it's very clearly, here are all these things about, you know, this person or this moment that I'm going back to and like replaying and that I love so much. And like, you know, like even just like the hash brown egg yolk, I will always love you. Like, it's just like such a beautiful and simple kind of, it can seem silly on paper, but sort of like in that vein of how the song is unfolding, it's just like, here are all these like beautiful like moments with this person that I'm enjoying and remembering and recalling. I think that's really nice, and I just love the way that sounds.
It's hard to tell whether it's stream of consciousness or it just seems that way because we don't know what he's singing about. It could go either way. I'm inclined to believe that it probably all means something, but I don't know where it goes from.
It's full of domestic references. It's another one that harkens back to the theme of home and creating home where you can, finding home when you can, and finding it in having a very messy breakfast with someone, and that the sort of domestic intimacy that's...
A cocaine side boob kind of breakfast?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's cocaine stains on the kitchen counter from, you know, the night before, I guess, when he spilled the beer on the little freak's friend. A lot of kitchens on this album, a lot of, you know, but this one has probably the most well-rounded breakfast on the album.
Yeah.
That there's pancakes and eggs and hash browns and coffee, but there's a real sort of domestic vibe to this song, even, you know, in the midst of pop star life chaos. And that's something that definitely brings the theme of Harry's house and home.
It feels like there's like a lot of like almost like inside jokes and memories too. Like, it's like this like loaded sort of like, you know, someone just kind of sat down and wrote down like all their favorite memories with a person and was like, let me just like string this together as to like my favorite things about, you know, spending time with them. I love this song. I think it's just like so beautiful.
It's impressionistic. As you were, you're 100% right. James Joyce should be scared. He should also be proud.
Yeah.
In so many ways, Harry's house is like Ulysses, and each song on Harry's house,
Brian just aggressively shaking his head,
lines up with a different chapter of Ulysses. I feel like this is the Sirens chapter on Harry's house.
For the record, I am affectionately shaking my head in disbelief. Everything good is in this song. Wine, weed, cyborgs, it's all good. Edibles, two different, actually, there's two different methods of taking in THC within four lines of each other. So that's good.
And that's beautiful.
Yes. Listen, it's...
Partly, like, I just love the way all these images come down to just the central question, should we just keep driving?
Yeah.
Which is such a romantic question in itself. You know,
there's
something about the intimacy between two people proceeding through the haze and the confusion. That something like really beautiful about how it comes down to that really prosaic, unliterary, unpoetic kind of line, but just it's really beautiful. Reminds me of the story Paul McCartney always tells about the song Two of Us, and how, you know, he wrote it. He was driving in the car with Linda. They were driving through the countryside. He got lost. He didn't want to admit it. And so they just kept driving around. They had no idea where they were going. And that's, they realized a lot about how in love they were that day. And
yeah,
that story seems like similar to the story in this song, but yeah. Keep Driving is one of my absolute favorites.
And Settle It.
You got a new,
I think I texted this to Rob like almost immediately after I heard it. But this song, I was shocked that Dev Hines is on the album. He plays cello on Matilda, right?
Yeah.
Like, I was shocked that Dev Hines had no hand in this, because this song reminds me so much of like his early production work. Like, it reminds me so much of like Spinning There Waiting For You, kind of like echoey effect on it. Reminds me so much of Everything Is Embarrassing and the Salon GP that Dev had worked on. Like, it reminded me so much of that. And it's, I mean, I love this song so much. It's just like such a, this is very in the vein of like As It Was, feels very like early aughts, like indie rock, festival rock moment. But it reminds me a lot of Blood Orange. And of course, Blood Orange and Harry have worked together before. And again, like a very, you know, just a very sweet song.
So many things going on in this song emotionally at the same time. Satellite has a different vibe from everything else on the album.
Yeah.
In some ways, such a happy song, in some ways, a sad song. In some ways, he's acknowledging the gap between these two people, but also, you know, there's that connection between them.
I'm like, in an LA mood. Don't want to talk to you.
I love that.
So good.
To me, this sounds very Bowie-esque, and there's something really kind of like Bowie about the sort of romance in this song, that there's a sense of overcoming that sort of alienation between the two people.
That bridge breakdown, too.
God, totally.
Incredible.
So, boyfriends.
Boyfriends, they think you're so easy. They take you for granted.
I was pleased to see they said in an interview that actually he was including himself in the sort of condemnation, because without that, I think one could take it, I think it leaves itself open to the accusation of pandering. Which I understand is not what he's doing, but I could see why someone might say that. It's like, oh, he's saying what his female fans want to hear. I personally could have used an additional verse where he explicitly admits that this has been him in the past, but it changed the whole way that I heard it once I saw that admission, that's the way he sees it. I would have preferred a verse where he made it clear that he's talking about himself too, but I'm sure, you know.
Would have been a different song.
Yeah, I want a different song. I'm asking for a different song. That's what I'm asking.
I like the song being what it is. I like that it's short and sweet. I like that it's powerful. Such a beautiful moment during the live show. This was at Coachella too, where, you know, the people who are singing and Mitch on guitar and the singers just gather up front. Really amazing to see Sarah Jones come out from behind the drums and just walk up to the front just to sing harmony. Just kind of amazing. Her goddess ascension. It's like, oh, like you weren't enough of a Sarah Jones fan already. Look, she doesn't even need the drums. It's just a really beautiful moment, a beautiful song, brilliantly placed. This is a absolute perfect second to last song on the album kind of song.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like, I think it kind of does work already as just sort of like this, you know, I am aware that I also do this, because I think there's a lot of references in the song that have been in the past songs, like, you know, like he'll get to drinking, like that's kind of come up in other songs of his and even in like, you know, One Direction songs, like that's kind of been a theme. Like there's a lot of things that you can kind of connect back to. You could play a little game of like, you know, like Harry sort of Easter egg hunting with like the way that he sort of even goes back to things that he's said about himself and a lot of the breakup ballads before. There is that kind of like hidden reflectiveness in it too.
It's kind of implicit. I love how he introduced it live at the show too. And he said, as he said at Coachella, this is for everyone who's had a boyfriend, everyone who's never had a boyfriend, but he added something on Friday. It's for anyone who's ever been a boyfriend or never been a boyfriend, or anyone who has any relationship to the word boyfriend or doesn't have any relationship to the word boyfriend. I love that.
Very inclusive, impressive.
I do not think it's possible to get more inclusive than that.
melodically, you can hear the Stevie Wonder again on this one, the closing track, Love of My Life.
Baby, you're the love of my life. Whoa, me.
That buzzy synth that kind of cuts against this, the sweetness of this song.
That synth, I mean, it's just like, I think there's a lot of, like, I think with a lot of the songs, especially the ones that I think have become my favorites, there are those sort of like surprising kind of musical choices that he makes in them. Like, you know, it's like the kind of crunchiness that happens in Daylight, or like that buzzy synth in here. Such a tender song. I love the way that he has described it as sort of like this ode to London and kind of like missing London. I think there's probably a million different reasons for this song, but I kind of love that. I thought that it was the, you know, sort of the Johnny on the song was like the kind of constant rock and roll Johnny of like many songs, but it is a reference to a friend of his from his hometown that he grew up with, which is also really beautiful. And that little piano part at the end is something that he previewed when he first announced Harry's House, and that's in like the preview video that he had dropped. And everyone's wondering, is this the single? Is this going to be? And I love that it's like the final thing that you hear in the album is the first thing that he played for everyone from the album. And it's just like a beautiful, delicate exit. And he said, I feel like his, you know, his openers and his closers on every album have been some of my favorites, that some of his favorite, some of my favorite tracks by him.
Absolutely. This one is such a powerful ending. Also, I love how, depending on the mood when you hear it, sometimes it feels like a sad, poignant song. Sometimes it feels like almost melancholic. Sometimes it feels like a beat banger. It's funny that this song sort of adapts to whatever kind of emotional lens you bring to it.
Yeah.
I love this one. Perfect ending. I agree.
His first two albums, the endings on those are so sad. Like, they're, yeah, like really, really sad. And there's a sense of longing on this one, right? There's a little bit of this like kind of, you know, I think anything that feels like nostalgic or like says like were, or feels inherently a little tinge of sad, but it also is just kind of so beautiful. And so there is like this very tender care to it. Whereas, you know, I feel like Fine Line from the last album is just like, so it's so depressing, you know. It's like, it's a nice sort of, there's a tinge of sadness to all three of the closing tracks he's put out. But I think this one is the most kind of optimistic and also, kind of more loaded with a little more joy than the others.
Yeah, I definitely hear that. It definitely, joy is the perfect word for it.
Mm-hmm.
But also that it sums up the theme, you know, like as you pointed out, the London references, but there's so much, you know, so many different kinds of home going on in this song that, you know, you can hear the song is about a person or about a place, but it's the idea that home is something that you build out of the things that matter to you, and defining yourself by what you love, and that's who you are.
Yeah.
Cool.
Brittany, is this song in your top five?
Yes. I like posted a top five, and I think it slightly changed, but I think Cinema and Keep Driving, it's hard to tell anymore which one is one and two. I feel like, again, like it goes back and forth. Sushi is a hard number three. What else did I put in it? Satellite and Love My Life. Yeah, those are the top five. That's like the songs that I am putting on repeat and are just like complete favorites. But the second half of the album is, I mean, I think with like Fine Line, the first half was my favorite. And I think with this album, the second half is like, has definitely become like a very on repeat part of the album.
Totally. And also I love, you know, there's two ballads at the end of the first half, and it's almost like he said, okay, you know, I made you suffer a bit with the ballads. Like, I really put you through the emotional ringer. Now you just get to dance the rest of side two if you want to.
And I think even the ballads aren't, none of them reach, I mean, Matilda is sad, but even like in terms of melody, like doesn't go as sort of like as kind of slow as like a Falling, for example. Like, I feel like all the ballads feel like very plucky kind of like folk moments, as opposed to like full-on kind of like weepy, you know. Matilda, I mean, lyrically Matilda is very weepy, but even just the way it sounds is still even a little bit more like mid-tempo, which I do also like.
Yeah, Kid Harpoon's guitar in that song is so beautiful.
Yeah.
That acoustic guitar. The cello that Dev Hynes plays is also really beautiful.
Yeah.
Reminds me a bit of a Hold Steady song called Citrus. I think of Matilda as a song that's very much a sort of mid-period Hold Steady song.
Yeah. But
there's a lot going on musically in each of these songs. I love that each song is such a mix of stuff.
Yeah.
I was thinking that maybe we quietly are in a golden age of singer-songwriters again. Like maybe for the biggest golden age for singer-songwriters since the 70s. It's an interesting countercurrent again to what else is going on in pop.
Again, we're kind of coming out of a very distinct period that we all shared of the ongoing pandemic and everything. Like I think a lot of artists had time off for the first time in a very long time. And I think that allowed them to experiment and think about life and about their own perceptions of things. Like this is very clearly a pandemic album in the same way that Happier Than Ever by Billy is. And that in the same way that, you know, that Folklore and Evermore were like this is an album coming from a time where a lot of artists aren't doing the things that they are so used to doing. And especially you have someone like Harry who has toured pretty extensively since he was a teen and has lived a very specific kind of life since then. And I think probably was able to take a little time to think and write in a different way than he's ever been able to before.
Didn't Harry say something like the original idea was an acoustic EP or something like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be his Folklore, I guess. And then there was little elements of that left. It's interesting.
And then we get all these bops. And I got to say, love the bops. I'm glad that we got this.
And that's our show for today. Thanks again to Rob Sheffield and Brittany Spanos. Rolling Stone Music Now will be back next week. We are a podcast. We're also on Sirius XM's Volume, Channel 106. Download us as a podcast. Subscribe to us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts because it's always appreciated. But as always, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.